ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. It's a podcast explaining one big news story affecting your world in just 15 minutes. From ABC investigations to politics, the cost of living, to major global events. Expert guests and journalists join me to explain why the world works the way it does. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. Geopolitics has been full of a lot of chess metaphors lately.
It was like a checkmate on the supreme leader. It was absolutely brilliant military strategy.
President Trump is hoping that this latest chess move of his was enough.
So at the moment, it's kind of like a big game of aerial chess.
So it's really checkmate on not only Iran, but China as well.
We lost. Checkmate, right?
Now, I've played a fair bit of chess, and I've learned that people with different personalities play the game in different ways. I, for example, do not have the patience to learn how to play the game properly, so my go-to move is an opening known as the Scholar's Mate. It involves starting the game with an explosive attack using my queen and bishop. If it goes to plan and your opponent is caught off guard, you can win the game in four moves. If your opponent realizes what you're doing, which, if they're any good at chess, they probably will, you can find yourself in quite a bit of trouble.
The Scholar's Mate might look dangerous, but in reality, it's one of the worst choices your opponent can make against you.
If it doesn't work, your queen gets trapped right out in the open. When it comes to geopolitical chess, I think the Scholar's Mate is pretty much how Donald Trump approaches foreign policy.
Covert units go after the main prize. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores, who are now in custody in New York.
Sometimes the move works, and he's won the game almost before it starts.
President Trump made it clear who was now in charge.
Well, we're going to be running it with a group, and we're going to make sure it's run properly.
But at other times, his opponent recognizes his plan, and it doesn't work at all. Case in point, Iran.
More than a week after Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was assassinated, his son, Mojtaba Khamenei, has been chosen as his successor. The 56-year-old hardliner is expected to carry on his father's legacy.
Trump went all out, and now his metaphorical queen is stranded, and he's found himself in deep, deep trouble. Based on my experience of playing chess, grinding yourself to victory from this position is very difficult.
The new opinion poll shows that most Americans actually think this war is a mistake. It's extremely unpopular, in fact, as unpopular as the Iraq conflict was.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is playing this game of chess too, but he's got a far more complex strategy than Donald Trump.
Xi Jinping's rise to unrivaled power in modern Chinese history has exceeded all expectations.
Xi is playing positional chess, spending literally years organizing his pieces, getting ready to claim the ultimate prize.
A major speech by President Xi Jinping that once again threatens the use of force in Taiwan.
For a lot of hard-nosed geopolitical commentators, this is the sign of a man with a plan.
Looking at the pictures from Beijing and the political propaganda, it's very clear this one man's grip on the world's largest country appears to be stronger than ever.
Donald Trump and Xi Jinping's different gameplay styles came to a head last week when Trump visited Beijing. Much of the talk was about how much better prepared the Chinese seemed than the Americans.
Donald Trump is certainly coming into this summit on the back foot, bogged down by the ongoing quagmire of the Iran war.
The thing is, though, despite the contrast between the two players, one impulsive, one highly prepared, I think they're both making massive, fundamental mistakes. We've spent a long time exploring the flaws in Donald Trump's gameplay strategy. So, for the next few episodes, I want to look at how Xi Jinping is operating. He's playing the very, very long game to take control of Taiwan. But at what cost? So, set up your pawns and buckle up. I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. In November 2010, a big opening ceremony was held in Sri Lanka. There were dozens of drummers, dancers, and government officials present. It was a real party atmosphere, which was surprising given where the event was being held.
Hanban Toda on Sri Lanka's southeast coast was in part of the region devastated by the tsunami in 2004.
But despite very recent catastrophes, the folks there were clearly very excited about the future. Not only was Sri Lanka spending billions of dollars on new infrastructure, it was also trying to win a bid against Australia to host the 2018 Commonwealth Games in Hanban Toda. The trouble was, they were facing quite a handicap.
I'm afraid I've never heard of Hanban Toda, so I had to look it up on the map.
It's not surprising the Australian officials who were also trying to bid for the Commonwealth Games hadn't heard of Hanban Toda. It was a city of only around 50,000 people, and yet there was this massive effort to put it on the map, primarily because it was the hometown of the sitting Sri Lankan president, Mahinda Rajapaksa. The president was dumping enormous funds into the city, building an international airport there and an enormous artificial shipping port, dug using enormous machinery out of a patch of coastal farmland. That's what the big party was about, the inauguration of this new harbour on President Rajapaksa's 65th birthday. The thing is, though, the harbour wasn't actually ready. There was an enormous rock sitting in the mouth of the port, just beneath the surface of the water. Thankfully, they discovered the rock with an underwater survey before any large ships learnt about it the very, very hard way. But there was also another elephant in the room, literally.
Every night, wild elephants roam through the surrounding countryside. They loom out of the darkness, then disappear into the jungle or someone's garden.
Wild elephants, which had historically grazed in the area and were unperturbed by the large fences, regularly trampled through the port area looking for food.
As in much of the world, an exploding population of humans has created a war with nature.
The biggest problem for the new port of Hanban Toda, however, was that even if they could get the underwater rocks and elephants under control, nobody actually wanted to use it. Especially when Sri Lanka's capital Colombo, which is just 260 kilometres away, had a very well-developed port that was more than capable of handling all of the country's trade requirements. The multi-billion dollar Mahinda Rajapaksa port in Hanban Toda was a white elephant being periodically attacked by grey ones. The Sri Lankan government had taken out massive loans to build it, which they then struggled to pay back. But that was okay, because they quickly found a buyer.
China Merchants Port Holdings is taking charge of the commercial and administrative management operations of the Hanban Toda port.
A Chinese government-owned company bought a 99-year lease of the port, and it wasn't the only one they bought.
Recently, it's been expanding, snapping up ports in Sri Lanka, Taiwan, and Djibouti in the Horn of Africa.
The company, called China Merchants, owns a lot of profitable ports, but in the last decade, it's been buying up ports like that one in Sri Lanka that make no financial sense at all. 15 years after this port opened, most ships still just sail right past it on their way between Africa and Asia, so it doesn't make a lot of revenue. The only reason anyone would want to own it is because one day in the future, you might want to exert some influence over the traffic going past you through the Indian Ocean. So, Xi Jinping buys a port on a key global shipping route. In other, more chessy words, Knight to B5. Seems to make sense, right? So, what's his next move? Well, let me take you to
an exotic alien landscape, high on the rooftop of South America.
We're in Bolivia, at the world's largest salt flat.
Beneath the salt pan surface, a vast buried treasure valued at more than $1 trillion.
It's not gold, it's not silver, it's lithium.
Lithium, the world's lightest metal, has a seemingly mystical range of applications.
Lithium could substitute oil in the future.
So Bolivia could become the Saudi Arabia of South America.
of the world.
Lithium-ion batteries are playing an enormous role in the global transition to renewable energy, and Bolivia's salt flats have the largest lithium deposits in the world. The problem is, it's Bolivia.
Bolivian President Evo Morales and his mines minister are resolute. They plan to harness lithium at their own pace.
The socialist Bolivian government won't just open up the salt flat for a foreign mining company to exploit and ship the profits overseas. And even if that wasn't the case, the flat is not exactly easy to access.
A freezing nowhere, 3,700 metres above sea level.
It's in the middle of the Andes, hundreds of kilometres from the coast. We know that it's incredibly difficult to access because many have tried. On the banks of the salt flat, there is a train graveyard full of locomotives abandoned by failed mining ventures. This renders exporting the lithium or any resources over the Andes very expensive. Fortunately, other countries also have lithium, which is much more conveniently located.
Australia is the biggest producer of lithium in the world.
While the landlocked Bolivians try to figure out how to get their lithium to the coast, the famously sea-girt Australians did what they did best, digging up rocks and shipping them to China.
Galaxy Resources is a Perth-based company mining lithium near Ravensthorpe in WA's South Coast region. All its lithium goes to China, straight to its own factory in Jiangsu province.
In 2022, the price of lithium skyrocketed, largely because of a surge in demand for electric vehicles. So Australian miners began cashing in.
The spot price for the raw material is now more than $8,000 a tonne.
This all could have been very simple for China. Just buy lithium from established producers like Australia and Chile. No worries, as we say in Australia. Ya po, as they say in Chile. But Xi Jinping had a more complex plan.
China is playing a very, very clever, long-term strategic game. They are looking to dominate the world in industries of the future, and they see the low emissions profile sector as an opportunity to be the world leader.
And buying lithium from Australia and Chile, two strong allies of the United States, was, in their view, not ideal. So China started investing billions of dollars into developing lithium mining operations in Bolivia and scaling up its own domestic lithium mining capacity. Jiangxi province in eastern China has lithium deposits, but they're low quality and very expensive to extract. But that didn't matter because China was determined not to buy from a US ally. Once they were up and running, Jiangxi's mines started flooding the market with cheap lithium, despite running at a massive loss.
That extra supply, combined with slower demand for batteries and EVs, sent prices tumbling.
For Australian lithium miners like MinRes boss Chris Ellison, the situation was dire.
It's not a fun time. I mean, this is the shittiest time to be the MD of a company. I mean, you've got to really carve the costs out of everything you're doing. You look at every single person. We're doing that. We're throwing everything off the deck just to make sure we conserve cash.
China's grip on the market meant many Australian mines were shut down as prices fell below the cost of production. This strategy by Xi Jinping isn't unique to lithium either. As we've discussed on this show before, China has managed to monopolize production of all sorts of critical minerals by running their mining and processing operations at a loss and ignoring environmental regulations. Ever since he was inaugurated as president in 2013, Xi Jinping has been spending literally trillions of dollars on global infrastructure projects that make little to no economic sense. Railway lines across Africa, pipelines across Pakistan and Myanmar, stadiums in Solomon Islands, ports scattered all around the world. He's been arranging his pawns, moving his knights and bishops and rooks into position. Why? Well, Xi Jinping is rather taken by a concept called the Thucydides Trap.
So-called Thucydides Trap.
Which is all about Thucydides Trap.
Again, I don't want to fall into the Thucydides Trap.
It's a bit of a favourite topic among a certain type of Australian Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister may yet again wheel out his Greek mythology lesson on the Thucydides Trap.
This is the so-called Thucydides Trap.
So let's hear former PM Kevin Rudd's explanation for what it is.
This guy up here,
He wrote the history of the Peloponnesian Wars. And he made this extraordinary observation about Athens and Sparta. It was the rise of Athens and the fear that this inspired in Sparta that made war inevitable, and hence a whole literature about something called the Thucydides trap.
Now, this idea wasn't popularised by slightly overconfident and mildly pretentious Australian prime ministers, however. It was popularised by historian Graham Allison.
When a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power, in general, bad things happen. In the book, I look at the last 500 years. I find 16 cases. In 12 of the cases, the outcome was war. In 4 of the cases, not war.
So a rising power challenges a declining power, and that leads to war. 3/4 of the time, apparently, over the last 500 years. Xi Jinping is even more obsessed with this theory than Turnbull and Rudd, so much so that he brought it up in his recent summit with Donald Trump.
The world has reached a new crossroads. Can China and the United States move beyond the so-called Thucydides trap?
For Xi Jinping, the theory of the Thucydides trap has given him a to-do list. Conflict between the two powers is likely, so he wants to be prepared if it happens. The problem for Xi Jinping is the Thucydides trap theory is based on conflicts between great powers over the last 5 centuries. But it's worth noting that since World War II, there have been no direct conflicts between great powers at all. That's because the invention of nuclear weapons and a globalized economy actually makes going to war directly illogical. You can't attack the other superpower without destroying yourself too. Mutually assured destruction has dismantled the Thucydides trap. But despite this, Xi Jinping keeps preparing for a conflict that he thinks is inevitable. So, why? Well, I'm pretty pleased with the chess metaphor running through this episode so far. And fortunately, there's a chess term for this strategy. It's called Zugzwang. It's basically a situation where one player forces the other into making a move that puts them in a worse position than before. In chess, you can't skip a turn, so invariably, there will come a time when you need to make a move that weakens your game. Xi Jinping has spent his entire presidency preparing for this, trying to engineer a Zugzwang so that the US can't do anything to attack China without weakening its own position. Slowly but surely, over the years, Xi has been moving his pieces into the perfect position, almost impossible to breach. He's built his own supply chains and an economy that is large, powerful, and so integrated with the rest of the world that if the US were to hit China with sanctions, it would be enormously costly to everyone. He's inherited a large nuclear weapons program and military, both of which he's invested in to make China even more difficult to challenge. He's established relationships with maritime ports in key locations that could be used as military bases if the need arose. He's used Chinese funds to build diplomatic alliances all over the world, from Hungary to Russia to Venezuela to Iran to Solomon Islands. The question is, though, why? The US has been at Zugzwang for years. They were probably at Zugzwang before Xi Jinping even became the president. Now, if not for this very long list of things I've spent the last few minutes ticking through, most countries around the world would be absolutely thrilled to trade and cooperate with China. It's a manufacturing powerhouse. It's invested incredible amounts in developing new technology, and it's also very cheap. So why does China insist on doing all those things and jeopardizing potentially very lucrative trade deals? Well, Chinese state media told us the answer to that question explicitly during the summit with Donald Trump.
Xi Jinping emphasized that the Taiwan issue is the most important issue in China-US relations. If handled well, the overall stability of bilateral relations can be maintained. If handled poorly, the two countries will collide or even come into conflict.
Xi Jinping wants Taiwan.
China considers Taiwan its territory, and any military effort to retake the island is a legitimate act of reunification.
Bringing Taiwan under Beijing's control has been an obsession of Xi Jinping for years.
As the wheels of history roll forward towards national reunification and the revival of the nation, the complete reunification of the motherland must be achieved and definitely can be achieved.
And Xi makes absolutely no secret of this desire. China has staged giant military exercises simulating the invasion of the island, and ships have been built and modified specifically for that purpose.
The report prepared for the Pentagon claims China's commercial ferries are being reinforced to transport tanks. It claims more than 70 large ferries are being built and modified to work with specialized mobile harbors.
But all this preparation doesn't negate two facts. One is that modern advances in weaponry have meant that every attempted invasion of the 21st century has gone incredibly badly for the guy doing the invading. The other thing he's ignoring is that he's already at Zugzwang himself, meaning many of the potential moves that China could make would weaken their position. And that's because, despite all of the preparation, China's economy is still very fragile. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz in March has shown that even a small blockade can disrupt global supply chains enough to have serious effects on China's economy. But that's just the start of it. Xi Jinping has got 99 problems, and the Strait of Hormuz is just one of them. In fact, he's got more like 1.4 billion and 99 problems. Ever since he took office in 2013, the spectacular economic growth that the Chinese Communist Party uses as justification for their authoritarianism has been in decline, and it's putting the Chinese people in financial distress.
Business is now very average. We're actually losing money.
The employment environment is not that good.
Education costs are very high, and China's patchy public healthcare system only provides basic care. A serious illness can wipe out a family's finances. So Chinese people tend to save their money rather than spend it. Most put that money in what they consider to be a safe investment, property. The trouble is,
across China, the property sector has collapsed. International investors are bailing.
Massive dysfunction in the property and construction industries led to a financial meltdown.
Millions of everyday Chinese people who thought they were doing the smart thing have been left paying mortgages for homes that haven't been finished.
1.4 billion and 99 problems. The trouble is, not one of these problems is helped by Xi's decision to spend an eye-watering amount of money on elephant-plagued ports in Sri Lanka, or investing in train graveyard-adjacent Bolivian lithium mines. And the economic effects of a war over Taiwan could make all of those problems exponentially worse. Now, this notion of spending enormous amounts of money on security and foreign adventurism while your domestic economy stagnates is not new. We all know that there's one particular country out there periodically spending billions of dollars bombing the Middle East while its own bridges fall down and citizens with full-time jobs go bankrupt paying for insulin. But that's just America being America, right? We're familiar with the pathology of a US president launching a scholar's mate attack on a vastly less powerful country, having done no preparation beforehand for what he'll do if it all goes wrong. But just because Xi Jinping has spent years meticulously preparing for a war rather than launching a high-speed attack does not mean he's in the right. Because that would imply that war is inevitable, and leaders only have agency over the way they prepare for and engage in that war. The thing about this chess metaphor is it implies that the game must go on. It doesn't have to go on. It's a game you don't actually have to play at all. The better metaphor may not be two titans sitting down to play an epic chess match which will decide the fate of the world, but rather two dudes playing chess on their phones while bills pile up on their kitchen table. They could just put their phone down and start addressing that very long list of problems. But as we all know, mobile phone games can be very addictive. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. Supervising producer is Kara Jensen-McKinnon. It's produced by Adair Shepherd and Pat Sunderland. Our tongue twister of the week is investing in train graveyard adjacent Bolivian lithium mines. Try saying that more than two times quickly. This is the first of what we're expecting will be a several-part series on Xi Jinping's ambition to take control of Taiwan. Next Thursday, we're going to go back to the beginning and the bizarre story of how the Chinese nationalist government ended up in exile on an island that was not at all excited to host them. Next Tuesday, though, we're taking a look at a proposed utopian tech city created by a team of Silicon Valley's most powerful billionaires, headed by a Czech national with a serious obsession with California. The city is set to be called California Forever. I'll see you then. Train graveyard adjacent Bolivian lithium mines. Train graveyard adjacent Bolivian lithium mines. Train